We have two bills this morning. We have Senate Joint Resolution 39, which we have previously heard, and we have House Bill 342, which we will take up secondly. I would like to first address Senate Joint Resolution 39. We took testimony, had discussions about it. Okay. We do have a quorum, Representatives Long, Ogun, Osterman, Cott, and Green are present.
The good guys.
The good guys. And unless there is some issue that has come up since we heard this last, I would entertain a motion to move this from committee. Anyone?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, I move SCS for Senate Joint Resolution Number 39 Resources. Individual recommendations.
Thank you, Representative Cott. Is there any question? Any objections? Hearing none, that has been moved, and that's a good way to do it. However, we have the other side of that coin now. We have before us, a CS for House Bill 342. And there, I thought the sponsor would be here, but
she's online.
Oh, she is. No, the sponsor of the bill.
Oh, yeah, he's making copies of something.
We'll set at ease for a few minutes while we find the sponsor of this bill. And we do have.
We'd want to go out of committee already, don't we?
Sorry. Oh,
he's coming.
We have. Marilyn Crockett with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation, Alaska Oil and Gas Association in Anchorage on teleconference. Marilyn, can you hear us?
Yeah, we got it.
Okay. And we also have a call in from Fairbanks, as I understand. Okay. Yes, we can. Very
okay,
well. We have a sponsor here now. We just wanted to make sure we had you live. The sponsor of the bill is here, Representative Rookberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you have before you a draft CS provided by Ms. Crockett. Also, you should have additional information from the Resource Development Council, which fundamentally supports the approach taken in this draft CS. I know we've all just recently had an opportunity to look at this and haven't had time to digest it, so I'm waiting with, as you are, Mr. Chairman, with bated breath to have Ms. Crockett explain what this CS does.
Are you ready for me now?
But I would just add further that conceptually I like the direction it's taking. I think it's something we can get behind, and hopefully the testimony will bear that out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all I have at this time.
Are there any questions of the sponsor until we hear from Aoga? Marilyn, I have not actually gone through your proposed amendment. Is that does it take into consideration some concerns I had expressed previously about lines 5 and 8 and other lines in the bill of the C version? On receiving water rather than water received and the Imhoff cone volumetric method, does your amendment take care of those issues?
Yes, sir, I believe that it does. The amendments to the lines 5 and 7 that you talked about with the question of the receiving water versus water being used or water received, we've amended that. The Imhoff cone requirement is still contained within this bill, as well as one additional amendment that we're proposing that would require the use of EPA methods for all methods that are used within the state. So there's actually two versions of the testing method, subject matter, if you will.
All right. And you are prepared to kind of lead us through this this rather lengthy amendment?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Would you identify your association and please proceed?
Sure. My name is Marilyn Crockett. I'm the Assistant Executive Director for the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. And I'm also the staff person who manages our environmental committee and environmental group. This
Marilyn, could you excuse me just one moment?
Sure.
Have we heard yet whether they're calling?
They haven't sent me a message saying he's added yet.
Okay. Would you let me know when he does? The reason I interrupted you, Marilyn, I'm sorry, is that we have a call in from Fairbanks, and I was hoping that they might be on so they could hear this, but please go ahead.
Okay. I'm assuming that the two-page description of our amendment is, or I guess it's, two pages, has been distributed to the committee members along with the amendments. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, that will help us a little bit. If we look at the first two amendments, the first two sections, B and C, they're identical. They just affect two different sections of the statute. What we've done in those two sections is to add a provision at the beginning that says, except for a water body included on an EPA-approved 303D impaired water body list, we recognize the concerns that DEC has identified and others, and frankly, we have the same concerns, that there are water bodies in the state that have been degraded for whatever reason, naturally or because of other impacts, that we are trying to clean up. With the inclusion of this phrase at the beginning of these two sections, that the water bodies included on that 303D impaired water body list are those water bodies. And in those cases, discharges should be required to discharge a higher water quality to that water body so that the water body can be improved. That's the reason for the introductory sentence there. The other changes that we suggested to these two sections take into account the concerns that DEC also has expressed on the possible misuse of some of the terms like criteria, standard, and so on. That's why we changed the word standard in one place. And then the rest of the section, of both of those sections, requires that the discharge cannot be more restrictive than the existing quality of the receiving water. The receiving water body that's actually receiving this discharge is the water body of concern. So that's why we've made the two amendments there.
Thank you, Marilyn. And I might interrupt one more time. Do you have any concern about, as you're going through this, if there are questions the committee, we'd address those at that time, or would you prefer to go through it and then address questions later?
Actually, we can do it either way. Perhaps as we go section by section, I'll pause, and if anyone has any questions, they can ask me then, and then at the end of the presentation, they can ask me any other questions.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much. Any questions about these first two sections that she's just described? Representative Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that DEC has some concern about specifically including the reference to the 303D impaired water bodies list in statute, and the reason for that concern, as I understand it, is that it then makes the whether a body is included or not on that list a much more contentious issue, and whereas now they've been able to kind of work back and forth on that list, and it hasn't been such a major issue about what whether a particular stream is or is not on the list. Once we put it in statute, their concern is that then those concerns will be elevated and it'll become a contentious and perhaps even an item that gets litigated. Do you have any reaction to that concern?
Well, I hadn't heard that concern. I think that obviously the 303D and the 305D water quality assessment report has been a rather contentious issue since the state started conducting that analysis, back in the late 1980s. The most recent review that the state has done, DEC did a very good job of identifying water bodies as being candidates for inclusion on the 303D list. They're taking a much closer look at the criteria and at the data that they have on these water bodies before they actually put them on that list. So I'm not sure about the question of whether or not the water bodies could be litigated, but I do know that DEC has elevated the standard, if you will, that they are now using before they actually put a water body on that list. They feel that they actually have to have hard data and good information to justify listing that water body.
I understand we have Mac McLean on now. Do you have, and I would invite you, Mac, if you hear something that you would like to talk about or would a question comes up, please join us.
Thank you very much.
He's a big part. He's with DEC in Fairbanks. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Fish and game. I'm sorry.
Do we have something with DEC?
Mr. Chairman, are you ready for me to go to the next section?
Yes.
The next section on line 14 has the requirement.
Yeah,
we're suggesting that, in addition to the MHOS cone requirement, which is the next section, that the measurement of constituents to determine compliance with permit limitations should be by methods that are approved by the EPA. We should be using the EPA methods for determining compliance in all cases. Those methods are tried and true. They've gone through significant review and examination before they're implemented. And in many cases, the EPA methods are used in the water quality regulations as well as other state regulations.
Are there any questions about that either from the sponsor or from members of the committee? Or from Fairbanks? Mac, do you have any concern about that?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Osterman.
Just to be sure that now the EPA standards are not any tougher than what we have currently have or are using in the state.
They are.
Marilyn, do you have an answer for that?
As to whether EPA standards are tougher than what we have?
Yes.
The state could not be in compliance with the federal rules unless the state rules are consistent with the federal rules. So basically the answer to that question, I guess, is no. We could not keep our programs unless we have rules that are at least as stringent as the federal requirements.
This is Mac McLean from Fairbanks. I've got a question here. Perhaps DEC can answer it, but there is some concern. I know the state has been trying to move towards a dissolved parameter for toxics and metals, and EPA criteria is currently total recoverable. To what extent would putting this in statute limit the state's ability to try to go to what we think is a better, more representative analysis of metals?
Representative Roper.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think he's referring to the question I have was specifically the arsenic situation and how that fits in. And Ms. Braley, I think Thomas, you'd like to.
Would you identify yourself, Ms. Braley?
Sure. I'm Susan Braley. For the record, I work for the Department of Environmental Conservation and Water Quality Technical Services Program. I just got this late yesterday and actually didn't really have a chance to look at it, so I haven't been able to, fully assess and look at the language to see how it actually would fit in with our statutes. I guess just and I'm not sure I can answer Mac McLean's question at this time, although I can certainly go back and talk to staff and come back with an answer to that. Right now, what we are doing with the water quality standards we are doing a lot of evaluation and a lot of research. One of the things that we are researching is the need for total there was a question raised about total suspended solids and whether we need a standard in
EPA.
Alaska. I don't believe EPA has a standard for suspended solids. They have monitoring requirements, but I don't believe that they have an actual standard, although again I'd need to check with my technical staff. We at this time do not have a our standard for sediment in the water quality standards is a settleable solids method using the Imhoff cone, or is settleable solids using the Imhoff cone method. During the Sierra Legal Defense Fund, the SCLDF petition that was filed in January, they raised questions about whether we needed to have a total suspended solids. And they actually were suggesting that we needed to go back and make immediate changes to the regulations to include total suspended solids. What staff did with that, as well as some other issues that SCLDF raised, was just kind of launched into some research and looked at what other states are doing. Most of their states, as I understand, don't have a total suspended solid. So therefore, you have to ask yourself why, how would it serve the state if we did, and how would we measure it, and what meaning would it have? What we committed to in August, when the governor's office met with four representatives of both development and environmental groups, we agreed to do a study and come out with a report in July on the need for a total suspended solids criteria. And the other thing we're researching is the need for our particulate hydrocarbon, particulate petroleum hydrocarbon criteria. And both of those studies have been delegated to staff who have expertise in that particular area, and we're actively working on it now. So, you know, to I can't say, you know, right off the bat to answer Mac's question whether or not the language in here would preclude us from maybe coming up with a system that works better in Alaska. I'd have to look into that. Offhand, I don't have any, I can't see any immediate problems with having a, you know, a statement that says we shall use methods approved by the Environmental Protection Agency. And I think, I don't know, Marilyn, can you answer, is that directly related to the petroleum hydrocarbon criteria and the methods that DEC cited to be used?
It's not directed specifically at that, but rather at the entire water quality regulation. We just believe that there is no reason to spend a lot of time and effort identifying other methods when we have EPA-approved methods which have gone through significant review and drill, if you will, that would serve our uses just as well. Susan and others, later on in the bill, we identify, we're also suggesting that state regulations be consistent with the federal regulations and no more stringent. We also provide a mechanism for situations where the state might want to have a more restrictive standard or a standard that perhaps the federal government does not have. I think that these testing methods fall into that same caveat. So, for example, if there was a test method, if the state identified a standard that the feds didn't have, let's use that scenario, and the state also wanted to identify a method to test for that sample, that section would allow the state to do that if they went through the demonstration process that followed.
Okay. Because we do, for the record, I'm sorry, Susan Braley, we do have that in our water quality standards now. You know, we cite the standard methods for the examination of water and wastewater. And, you know, where applicable, we have made specific recommendations on a particular method of testing for that criteria.
Well, I wonder, and perhaps, excuse me, Marilyn, you could address this too. If we specify certain tests and don't specify other tests, are we in jeopardy perhaps of actually not doing the job that we should? And I guess I'm not saying that very well, but quite often when you list a litany of tests and leave out one, then that one is by its absence is no longer considered, whereas by leaving it this way, we are tied to at least the standards of the federal government, which has been referred to earlier, that we would not have any more restrictive than, and then this would be it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you're exactly right. I think if the amendment to Section A that requires that all of the methods that the state uses be approved by, be the EPA-approved methods, that would meet AOBA's concerns and AOBA's interests, and I think that would take care of those other problems.
Representative Davies. Incidentally, Representative Davies and Williams have joined us.
A long time ago.
A long time ago. At least 5, 10 minutes. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marilyn, I'm concerned. I mean, I understand what you're saying here, and I think, as a general proposition, it makes sense to use tried and true methods. But I guess I'm wondering if you would be resistant to language that would sit. That would accept those cases where such a method didn't exist. In for example, in the instance where we might have a standard that EPA didn't, and also language that would accept the case where the state actually placed in writing a rationale for using some different standard.
That would be acceptable to us, Representative Davies. Perhaps it could be added to section on the next page, small paragraph F, which addresses situations where the state might want to adopt a more restrictive standard or a standard that the federal government does not have. If we include the word methods or whatever the right terminology is somewhere in that section, that might address your suggestion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Representative Roker.
On that point, I think there's been testimony passed and about some standards being raised to the point there was not a perfectly verifiable methodology of management, and that's causing concern for industry. I'm concerned, are we getting into that type of thing if we open that up? I'm just
when we get to that point, we might be able to phrase it such that we would not get in that problem.
Right,
appreciate that. Any other comments to this point? Hearing none, go ahead, Marilyn.
All right. On page 2, the section that begins on line number 4, the amendments that we have suggested to that section is lines 4 through 13. The first amendment, except for a water body, that addresses the situation that we talked about a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. with the two amendments on the previous page. The rest of the changes that we've made to that section, or that we're suggesting to that section, are to just change the terminology, perhaps to make it more consistent with some of the concerns that DEC has raised. Also, we suggested that paragraph 2, you see this in caps and in brackets there, that paragraph perhaps is not necessary if the other amendments proposed to the bill are adopted, because you would not have a case where you would have permit limits or standards that would be more restrictive than the applicable federal requirements, except for going through the demonstration process later on in the bill.
So we can kind of hold that in abeyance until we get through the rest of this?
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
this is...
Excuse me, Susan.
This is Susan Bailey again. I would like to take just a moment to address the whole issue of the 303D listed waters, maybe help you understand what that list is. And I do have strong concerns with carrying that list in the in our statutes for several reasons, and I just want to make sure that as we embark on this, we all understand what we could be getting the state into. The Section 303D of the Clean Water Act is where the quote 303D list comes from. This section of the Clean Water Act says that the state must come up with a list of waters that currently are not meeting water quality standards because controls in place are not cleaning up that water. And Section 303D then requires, and it's in regulation, that the state do what's called a total maximum daily load allocation. So if you've heard the phrase TMDL, which I don't know, you know, I sometimes wonder why EPA has to come up with these terminologies, NPDES and TMDL, that you hear them and they don't mean anything to somebody unless you ask them to repeat it again and say it slowly. The intent of Section 303,
statewide or water body wide, or when you're talking about this TMDLs?
The TMDL is done on a specific water body. Now, the reason Section 303D got added to the Clean Water Act was that the EPA, through the Clean Water Act, had a lofty, you know, very high goal of wanting to have all the waters in the U.S. cleaned up by the year 2000, I think, give or take. And their method to get there was going to be through the NPDES program. And again, for those that aren't familiar, the NPDES program is a permit program that requires any person that discharges into a water of the U.S., or any entity that discharges into a water of the U.S., unless it's deemed by EPA to be, you know, not be important enough to warrant an NPDES, they have to get this federal permit. So that's the only thing EPA was looking at the time to clean up the nation's waters. Well, they were, you know, I think doing a pretty good job of issuing permits and putting controls on industries. What they found, though, surprisingly to them, I guess, at first, was that the waters weren't getting cleaner. And when they went and looked at some of the water bodies, and, you know, maybe if you go to the Midwest where there's a lot of industry and you might have a section of the Ohio River where you've got six industries within a five-mile area discharging into the same river. And even with controls in place and in good faith meeting their permit, the water still weren't showing any improvement. So EPA created, or I don't know, Congress created Section 303D, which said that in those situations where you had a water body that wasn't meeting water quality standards and yet all the permits in place, all the controls were effective, then they would go to a TMDL method, and they would collectively look at the water body, look at all the industries that were on that water body, and they would do a total maximum daily load. They'd do a loading capacity of the river, whatever the particular pollutants might be that were being discharged, and they would say, you know, this river can only handle 50 pounds of sediment. And we see that with all these industries discharging, we've got 95 pounds of sediment going into that river. So through that TMDL process, they would then allocate. They would go back to each of the industries and say, we're going to cut your allocation back. Instead of allowing you to dump out 20 pounds of sediment, we're going to cut you all back to 10, so that the five of you will equal 50, and that water body will then start to improve for that particular pollutant. So it was originally a point source discharge program, and the statute hasn't changed. What EPA has done in the meantime is realize that where you have a lot of pollution coming into waters is not controllable. It's what we call non-point source discharge, which means instead of coming out of a pipe and you can clean up the end of the pipe and and you feel good about it, you have road runoff, you have agriculture, you have certain practices that are land use activities where you cannot nicely and easily prevent pollution from going into a water body. So EPA has taken the 303D list and kind of turned it into a everything. To me, it loses the meaning of what a TMDL is, because if you say total maximum daily load, it gives one the impression there's going to be a concrete amount that one can dump in. Now, how you tell a hill that's eroding into a stream to stop dumping that sediment or stop having those washouts during the spring, which then, brings sediment in, is still kind of a mystery to me, and I've been working a lot with EPA to kind of get them into redefining it. So I'm giving you all this history to lead up to what has occurred in Region 10 EPA in the last couple of years. States are required to submit 303D lists every 2 years. And in 1992 and 1994, the state of Alaska submitted a list of 39 water bodies that they felt met the definition of a 303D TMDL. EPA was being sued at the time, and I may not have all my, everything totally correct, but EPA was being, I think it was in Idaho, that they got sued by, I don't know if it was trustees or some environmental group that said that Idaho wasn't doing a good enough job of developing that list of identified waters which either had water quality problems or were threatened by some impending development that if you didn't immediately put controls on, you'd have a problem. Idaho came out with a list of about 150 water bodies. EPA, because of the lawsuit, disapproved the list and required them to go out with every water body that they had any kind of information on. The result of that and the lawsuit that went along with that was Idaho's list shot up to about 900. And that was the worst case scenario, but the same situation happened in Washington and in Alaska. Now, Oregon said, we're gonna hold off, we're gonna wait till see what happens to you all before we do anything. So they missed the 94 list. EPA disapproved our list. They did approve the 39, but they disapproved our list and required that we then go out with 130 water bodies, which was a broader list. We have other lists we use that help identify where there are problems, but we didn't consider them to meet the 303D listing. As a result of the public process and about over a year of working with EPA, we then finalized a list in 1994 of 56 water bodies. Now, to me, this list has means something different to everybody I talk to. The perspective of our perception of what this list means, to industry, if you get a water on the 303D list, it means that you're not going to be able to do what you wanted to do on it. To my perception from some environmental groups is that it means that once it's on the list, you can't do. That should be a marker of. To me, it means it's a list of something where we got problems and we need to do something about it. So I have looked at it as a tool that DEC is going to be using and is using to go in now and start to work with industry, work with communities, work with land use developers' activities, in order to get things back on track. So what I have done, and in fact, just coincidentally, Monday, April 1st, we are going to be turning in our 1996 303D list of waters to EPA.
There's no significance with the date on that list.
No, I actually, April Fool's and all that. Maybe there is. But the point that I want to make is that I am trying to diffuse the all the different perceptions of how this list, to me, it's important for DEC and the public and the industry because it recognizes that there are problems and that we are doing something about it. But what I'm trying to do with this list, EPA has, waters get on the list, and then the complaint I've gotten from industry is nothing ever comes off. So we got guidance from EPA in November. It was never, guidance, I guess, is not official regulation or statute. Nonetheless, we got guidance that said if we had an approved TMDL, and the state of Alaska has changed that terminology to a water body recovery plan, which we think makes sense to people, and, you know, recognizing that you can have a TMDL, approved TMDL, be a water body recovery plan. But to us, the terminology makes a lot more sense to people. The EPA guidance says that we can drop, if we have an approved TMDL and we see that it's going to be implemented or we have good faith that it's being implemented, we're putting it on a tracking list. And then we are continuing to work, you know, to monitor and track and see that things are improving. Now, we are going to delist those waters where we have approved TMDLs or we have what we consider a water body recovery plan that is showing that that things are improving. My fear or my concern about having something like the suggestion here in this committee substitute bill is that Marilyn had mentioned that we are using hard data and good information to put a water on the list. But quite frankly, in the state of Alaska, we will always be data poor. We will never have enough information to truly make a decision, for example, to, I think you could turn that argument right around and say, when can you pull something off a list if you're not quite sure that it's meeting water quality standards? Well, we've got the controls in place, we're working with the industry, we're monitoring, that's our assurance. Yeah, but let's see, but we don't want it to come off the list because if it comes off the list, nobody's gonna pay any attention to it, and something like this would I think exacerbate it. And so that's my main concern about putting the list in statute and then again elevating it and potentially having that list become much broader, because in some people's minds, if it's not on the list, nobody's going to pay attention to it. And I simply think that's not true, and I think we're setting up a good system that's going to allow us to make improvements, track where improvements are being made, and make this list work like it should, rather than be some magic list that says something will happen or will not. I appreciate having the opportunity to explain that.
Thank you for the background. I think it was very helpful, certainly to me, and I hope the rest of the committee. I have a couple of questions about that, though. On this list of that somewhere between your original list and EPA's 100 and some, are glacial fed streams and bodies like Cook Inlet, sediments that are suspended, were any of those streams selected because of that?
Because of the natural turbidity? No.
So that we have that many that we somehow are man-induced additional sediments.
Yes, and I don't have it with me, but I would be happy to, provide.
No, that's all right. I was just wondering about the criteria.
Actually, through the chair, you bring up a good point. One of the criteria that we look at when it goes on the list is whether it's human-induced. And we've gone through some deliberations on some old abandoned mining streams where EPA feels that there's manganese coming off of a stream caused because 40 years ago there was a mine there and it opened up the ore body and now we've got manganese. And sometimes we have a gray area because if there's reclamation that can be done and perhaps the Park Service is planning to do it, then, you know, one could say that it was human-induced and they're going to fix the problem. But we carefully evaluated to determine and look at other streams in the area to see if, you know, manganese is naturally there versus, so there are some gray areas. But to give you another example, we had several streams identified in the Anchorage area for fecal coliform. And EPA, you know, that is an indicator, or can be an indicator, that septic systems are failing. DEC worked with the municipality of Anchorage to look at where there were septic systems in the water bodies that were identified, where we had you know, sewage treatment, public sewage treatment going through there. And, you know, what one might conclude, especially if you live in Anchorage in the summer and you know that we're, you know, that's just a major waterfowl, you know, throughway, that fecal coliform is being caused by ducks and geese. And so those have dropped off the list. Now, we're down to a few. I think there were about a dozen. And we're down to two that are still in question because of, you know, that particular area having more septic systems than another area. But that's maybe a good example of where we aren't including a water body if it's something natural. And we don't intend to, you know, set off sound bombs to scare the ducks and geese away.
Well, the other question I had, and then I know there are several other questions among the members of the committee, your name change to water recovery body would, or a water body recovery plan would imply to me that something has to be fixed rather than that this is one that needs to be watched. And so I'm wondering about the tendency there, just by the definition of the term, is there perhaps something that's a little more user friendly that we could do?
We are open to suggestions. I felt strongly enough about the TMDL word, which I just, it sends mm-hmm. shivers up my spine because it gives people different perceptions. It doesn't appropriately tell me what's going on. I will. We do have baseline criteria that we use to develop a water body recovery plan, but. It varies. For example, we were down in Hammer Slough in Petersburg, which had been identified by EPA because there had been a complaint by a fishing gamer who had since retired that there was sediment coming into the creek, and they thought it was coming from the airport. We did a field study, went out there. The city was very concerned about it being on the list because they felt that Hammer Slough didn't have problems. We met with Fish and Game, the city manager, and actually spent a couple days tromping around, and I say we, it's my staff. And what they found was that there was some sediment washing off of an area where they had done some harvesting, timber harvesting at the end of the runway to remove, you know, some of the vegetation. And a quick fix, going in there and putting in some grass seed because what was running off was coming off a little hill. They identified three immediate things that could be done. And so we left after a two-day visit with what we felt was a good water body recovery plan. We got some commitments from city and Fish and Game. We are going to be tracking that this summer. We're going to try to get out there once more at the end of the summer. But to us, that was enough to say we've got a plan. Now, as another example, a water body recovery plan can be they're doing one up on Birch Creek right now out of Fairbanks, and it's taken several months. So I'm open to suggestions and do agree that probably what we need to do is, if nothing else, at least show the steps that we do to do a water body recovery plan. And with some water bodies, you might stop at step number one. And for other water bodies, you might have to go down to the 10th step.
Well, my bias would wonder if maybe we couldn't change recovery to perhaps something like quality control, water uh-huh. body quality control plan.
Okay, sure.
Anyway, Representative Ogun. Excuse me, Representative Long.
I just wanted to... You had made a statement about 30-some water bodies were identified, and later on, EPA said you need to identify 110. And based on what?
Sure. What we had done is we had a list of what we called suspect water bodies, where somebody had given us information to say that there might be a problem. We also had had a list of what we call impaired water bodies, which were water bodies where we see water quality problems, but we don't believe it needs additional controls. It might be maybe an enforcement issue with a particular, someone, and they need to make a correction, and that's all there is to it, so it's not it doesn't meet 303D. What EPA felt we did was they didn't feel like DEC gave the public the opportunity to comment on a broader list. I think and I was not working in this particular job, but I think they must have just gone out with the 39 waters, asked for people's comments, and then made the decision based on that. What EPA required DEC to go back and do was come out to the public with a much broader list, and therefore allow the public to comment on waters that they wouldn't have otherwise seen. And out of that, and the public comment on those 130 water bodies, we came up with a list of 56. So it was kind of a public process in allowing the public to comment.
Any other comments? Do you have any comments on what was said, Marilyn?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if using the terminology EPA approved 303D impaired water bodies list is the right answer or not. Our interest is in making sure that there's a provision for a qualifier contained within this that recognizes that there are water bodies that could not take the additional load, if you will, from discharges, and that a cleaner standard, cleaner in quotes, more restrictive standard needs to be in place for those water bodies to bring it back up to par. Furthermore, our interest is that we don't want a simple phrase in there that sort of indicates that if you think the stream has problems, then you can pass on these stricter limits. From our standpoint, there's got to be some standard of some measurement, some justification for having a water body in that category. It can't simply be because someone suspects that perhaps there's a problem there. So if the phrase, 303D impaired water bodies list is the wrong phrase, then let's find a phrase that makes sense and that doesn't perhaps raise the concerns that Ms. Braley has addressed, but has some technical justification for it.
Ms. Braley?
Mr. Chairman, I think what I'd like to ask is maybe if we go back and look at Section 1 and 2, especially going back to Representative Roper's original, and maybe just asking ourselves what we were trying to achieve there. And he may could defer to Representative Roper. My reading of it is that clearly, we do not want to be putting water quality standards on or forcing water quality standards on a stream that has naturally occurring pollution, you know, or maybe a pollutant that is, you know, is considered a pollutant if it's human induced, but maybe it's naturally occurring. You know, you go up north, you go out west, you know, Red Dog Creek is always kind of the premium example of where you have, you know, natural ore body washing out into a stream. I don't know if it would fit or not, but my thought, if I could just maybe offer a suggestion, might be, and I do appreciate the changes that that AOGA offered as far as the commissioner may not require more restrictive water quality for discharged water than the existing quality of the receiving water, perhaps changing that to, instead of existing, maybe natural quality, or somehow getting to the fact that what we don't want, and I think, and DEC is wholeheartedly in agreement. We are not here to try to keep a glacier from putting sediment into a stream or a river. Our intent is to make sure that human activities and industrial discharges are not putting human-induced pollution into a stream that is not naturally caused. And if that's what Representative Roper is trying to say, perhaps even a simple change like natural rather than existing would satisfy that.
Representative Roper.
Number one, one of my concerns, particularly after the initial hearing we had in the Oil and Gas Committee, was expressed by the environmental community there was no consideration taken in that draft for the receiving water if, in fact, it had already been substantially polluted with the wording. So this new draft does take that into account. I mean, I think we need to discuss further whatever standard we're going to use. But I think the prior oil and gas CS does suffer from a lack of consideration that there is whether it's an unnatural or existing body of water. It needs to be addressed for this to be a real work. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a problem about finding unanimity because these words have definitions that may be terms of art within the water quality trade, so to speak. So I really have to defer to the experts and legal advice. I did have a memorandum from our legal people that indicated the insertion of existing, I believe, into the statute would be repugnantly redundant. I mean, it got that bad.
Boy, that's so, I mean, yeah, no, we have been struggling with this very word. I mean, it's a true story. Not that I'm against that, but I think that this is something we've been struggling with for some time. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to point to one other something that may feed into this, and ironically, it kind of goes along with we've done just what EPA wanted us to do. So I'll preface what I'm about to say with the fact that EPA told us they would disapprove our regulations if we didn't add this in, and so we have probably met, I guess, the intent of some of this language, which says make sure you do what EPA does or what they want you to do.
Do we have to genuflect or?
Sometimes I feel like that. What we were required to include in our regulations is what is called an anti-degradation policy. And again, we've got another word that is a term that in and of itself is kind of confusing and hard to understand. But basically what the anti-degradation policy requires is that states, we have a water quality standard set, and what is happening now on some waters is we bring it right down to the edge. You know, we allow discharge or pollution to occur right down to the edge of where the water is, you know, going to be able to handle that. What the anti-degradation policy says in part is that water with natural characteristics of higher quality than the water quality criteria must be kept in the existing quality. And then it does have, unless an applicant comes in with a particular variance. So, you know, basically, and it gets a little more complicated than that, but basically EPA recognized that we have waters of high quality and we don't want to degrade them down to the point where they're still meeting water quality standards, but they're no longer in pristine condition. They're maybe just kind of hanging in there. So I would point that out, that I think we would probably have some conflicts with the federal requirement and our regulation, which we put in because EPA and the Clean Water Act said that we should, to recognize that there are waters of natural high quality that we need to consider. And I only point that out because, you know, if there's this insinuation that just a list of waters is the only thing that's going to drive, you know, the allowance of using that higher quality, I think that's not going to make it. And I don't know, Marilyn, if you are familiar with that policy or have any comments on that. I do appreciate hearing, because I have my perspective, and I know there are others out there.
Yes, I am familiar with the anti-degradation policy. I know that it was added, adopted by the department last September, and just became effective in the Alaska regulations on March 15th. I guess I wouldn't have a concern about, and Representative Roper, I'm sorry, but we couldn't hear you here in Anchorage, so I hope it was conflict with anything that you said a few minutes ago, but I guess AOGA wouldn't have any concern with changing the two existing the references to existing to natural. I think that's actually what that was intended to mean initially.
Representative Roker, would you want to be redundantly repugnant?
No.
Well, I think actually Mr. Armstrong,
you might want to move forward a little.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the Mining Association suggested natural also.
They did.
Right. But
we didn't want to try a new word.
Right. But with that in passing, I do have a concern. I know we're running timing-wise here, Ms. Chairman, but perhaps Ms. Braley or Ms. Crockett could comment briefly. I know there was a move afoot in Congress to repeal the anti-degradation requirement. Can anybody give us a status report on that?
Since that hasn't cut, maybe briefly.
Yeah.
This is Susan Braley. I'm not aware of any, and my water quality standards staff person has a lot of networking that she does with people back in Washington. We've also heard that we're going to get the arsenic standard changed, and it's been about a year since they admitted that it wasn't scientifically defensible. So, but I can check on that. Although EPA was quite insistent that if we did not include, and just to clarify what Ms. Crockett said, we included in our January 1995 regulations two provisions in the anti-degradation policy. We didn't include the third provision, which says that you have to identify what is called the Outstanding Natural Water Resource Waters, or ONRWs, just to give you another acronym that EPA made up. EPA told us quite emphatically in January, or after they reviewed our January regulations, that they were going to disapprove our regulations because we didn't have that third category. And I believe the reason the department didn't add it at the time was because how do you decide what's an outstanding natural resource water and what would be the significance of that? And so we left it out, but again, we're told by EPA that it's in the Clean Water Act and you better have it in. So it was a third part that we added in that is now effective or became effective in March.
One other thing, and I know Representative Williams has a question, but when I was in California, and you're not supposed to bring up other states necessarily, but there was a problem with natural seeps along Santa Barbara County, and condition A, there was a little bit. And then there was an erosion of, a sloughing, actually, of a bank, an embankment. And suddenly there was monitoring that showed that there was an increase of hydrocarbons in the water, and all sorts of ramifications began until they realized what had happened, actually, was that this exposed a much bigger area of natural seep. Now, how would you handle that in a situation like you mentioned earlier where there was a leachate going on, and so you establish this is natural, and then you allow a mining operation, for example, and then all of a sudden it goes up, which is in violation, but it's not, I mean, it may take some time to find out and may take some expense to find out that it isn't man-made.
That's a very good question. I think it probably identifies one of the areas that, those gray areas where we really have to do a lot of work on a case-by-case basis with the particular water body in question or the particular industry we're dealing with.
Thank you. Representative Williams.
Yeah. You're reading from that this book here. What page are you on? Could you go over that anti-degradation again, please? Excuse me.
Through the chair, if you look on page 2, if you still have your the water quality standards, which for the benefit of the people on teleconference, when I was here last Wednesday, or 2 days ago, I brought copies of the Alaska Water Quality Standards, 18 AAC-70. I will apologize up front. I brought the January 4th, 95 regulation. We had a whole slew of extra copies, and we're just now getting around to printing our new ones. So this is not the March 4th and does not include the one additional anti-degradation clause that Ms. Crockett mentioned. But if you look on the top of page 2, it starts with subsection little c.
Could you explain that? Ketchikan Pulp is always concerned about the type of water that they bring into the plant, and then the EPA says that it has to go out crystal clear. Well, in southeast Alaska, as you know, the water that comes into our drinking water, after a heavy rain,
is not drinkable.
It's dark.
Mm-hmm.
But Ketchikan Pulp uses that water, mm-hmm. cleans it, and lets it out, and it has to be crystal clear. Could you explain that? Does this get into that portion of the regulations?
Through the chair, I don't know if I can answer your question directly through this. With the anti-degradation policy, and again, questions like these, I really wish I had my staff here because they get into a lot more of the details than I have off the top of my head. The anti-degradation policy has some steps that one, must take to determine, to make sure you've applied that that clause. And I don't think in this instance what you described as far as taking in water that just naturally is not crystal clean. And then it's used by an industry, in this case, Ketchikan Pulp Company, and they then must discharge it cleaner than what they got coming in. I assume is your question. I don't think the anti-degradation policy addresses it. The anti-degradation policy addresses the water body that the discharge is going into. I don't want to get into the specifics on Ketchikan Pulp Company, but except to say that the discharge that they put out, because of the process that they use and some of the chemicals they use, and I think dioxins are maybe a part of it, it's considered a toxic pollutant. And so there's a portion of it that they aren't able to get out, and it's that toxic portion that people are most concerned about. So even though what they may have gotten coming in was, may have had some turbidity, it may have had some sediment, maybe had some color, which is really more of an aesthetic problem, they are using that water, putting something more into it, and then discharging a different type of pollutant. So.
Thank you. Ms. Crockett?
Mr. Chairman?
Just a moment. Ms. Crockett?
Yes, I'm here.
We seem to be in a position now that we're kind of in a hang point now. Is it your opinion that you could lead us through the rest of this, albeit that we may have some issues, we may want to resume? What I'm concerned about is that we're in a dialogue here and we have people on teleconference, so I'm wondering if we could go through, find the sticking points, and then maybe come back and address them, either what time is remaining or readdress those maybe on Monday.
Certainly. I think that we could go through the rest of this very quickly, even though it appears to be rather lengthy. Everything starting from F down is taken from another statute, so there's really only two more sort of issues to address.
Ms. Braley, would that be satisfactory to you?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Please go ahead then, Marilyn.
Okay, well, starting on 114.
Excuse me, one moment. Representative Brookberg had a question.
Oh, that was exactly, you parroted my suggestion.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, Marilyn, I'm sorry.
All right, on page 2, starting on line 14, the subparagraph D, and actually paragraph E, they're rather similar. The first paragraph D requires the department to review the state water quality standards and requirements to ensure that they're consistent with the federal standards within 12 months of the date of enactment of this legislation. The next paragraph requires the department to amend the state regulations within 12 months of any amendment of federal regulations. So if the federal standards were changed or went down, if the federal anti-degradation policy went away, for example, the state would have 12 months then to amend its regulations to bring them into consistency with the federal requirements.
Excuse me just a moment. Susan?
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to note, just for information, that all states are required every 3 years to do what is called a triennial review of their regulations. It's, again, in the Clean Water Act, and the purpose of that is just what Ms. Crockett is suggesting in this. Rather than every 12 months, every 3 years, we are required to go in, look at our regulation, look at the federal legislation that, or I'm sorry, look at the federal regulations that have been promulgated, and then, go through the process of determining whether they're appropriate and what you put out for public review. My concern probably about 12 months would be probably the reason we have every 3 years through the Clean Water Act, because things change. You have a lot of changes going on at once, and so you might have a federal regulation for one particular parameter come out in January of 96, and then 3 months later you have another Federal Register come out for another parameter, and then 3 months later you might have two Federal Registers come out for two parameters. And so the reason they do the triennial review is they recognize that every now and then you just got to stop, take a look at what's on the plate, and then move forward. And so I would add that just as a point of information.
What would happen, now I can understand that on a three-month basis, but I would think that within a three-month period, you would have a pretty good anticipation of what the federal government's planning to do because of the Federal Register review process and so on. But I'm a little concerned that if it were a three-year triennial type thing, what would happen if we were to pass this, that there couldn't be anything more stringent than the federal requirements, and after 6 or 8 months, which may not have been on the plate or even envisioned, is passed by the federal government, then we are in violation of our own law for as much as 2 or 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm concerned about waiting 3 full years. Maybe there could be something struck between 1 and 3, but.
Chairman, this is Marilyn Crockett. Perhaps an alternative might be, instead of requiring a change within 12 months every time EPA changed its regulations. Perhaps an alternative approach might be to say, as of January 1st of every year, DEC will amend its regulations to be consistent with the regulations that were in place, to amend its regulations to be consistent with the EPA regulations that were in effect on January 1st. That way there's only a 12-month or a one-time-a-year review that would have to take place.
Yes. Now, I'm going to invoke again that I don't want to get into this kind of discussion again. Mm-hmm. If this is where we're going to go for the next 30 minutes or so, I would rather move the bill into some other forum. If we can go through, find the sticking points, mm-hmm. well, we'll do that. Okay. So this is a sticking point. Okay, go ahead, Marilyn.
All right, Mr. Chairman, paragraph F, is that where we are now?
Yes.
F, that allows to adopt standards and methods that we mentioned earlier that would be more restrictive than the federal requirements or for which there is no corresponding federal requirement if the state went through a process of a demonstration process, if you will. And this gets into the citation that or the air program that I mentioned earlier. The rest of this bill is taken, starting on page 26 through pages 3 and 4, is taken from AS 4614, which is the Title V air legislation. The only changes that we made to it is to change air to water, for example, and to eliminate the provisions within the air statute that are obviously air-related. Everything else in this bill is taken directly from that air statute. That statute was developed in draft form by the Air Quality Legislative Working Group, which had representatives from the environmental communities, the oil and gas industry, other industries, municipalities, and DEC, and presented to the legislature and passed the legislature, I believe, 3 years ago. So it's sort of a tried and true process. It requires a demonstration of the need for the additional standards, the more restrictive standard. It requires peer review, and it requires DEC to produce findings on why those more restrictive standards would be appropriate for the state.
So it's process rather than specifically to any particular type of pollutant.
That's correct.
Well, that I think maybe we can find some common ground. Do you have any problem with that?
No, actually, I think that's probably not a bad idea.
Does the sponsor have any problem?
I concur. I think it's an excellent way to accomplish something we wanted to do, provide the state more flexibility by being able to provide a higher standard if the facts warrant that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davies.
Mr. Chair, I guess, I mean, of course, this is the first time we've really looked at this, and I'm not real familiar with the air quality issues either, so I'm wondering about what the demonstration project requires, and my concern is that in many instances, when you're trying to improve a water body, that might take decades. And is what envisioned here to actually demonstrate that you can improve a water body? Or what does the demonstration project accomplish?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If we turn to page 3, line 25, the demonstration would require that the state find that exposure profiles and hydrologic conditions or the discharge characteristics require a more restrictive standard in order to protect the human health and environment. It requires that it must be technologically feasible, and it requires a written analysis of the economic feasibility of the proposal be prepared. You then go on to require that the proposed standard go through a peer review process with three independent consultants retained by the state who would have no financial interest or no personal interest, if you will, in the proposal in any way, shape, or form. And then all of those documents that are presented to the public, along with the proposed rule for comments before adoption by the state.
And
so it's not directed at any particular water body, but rather at a standard, one of the water quality standards or methods.
And is that what you currently do on air?
Through the chair, I am not familiar with the air program, although I certainly will go back and talk to our director, who is Lynn Varelli, who is very familiar with it, and we'll find out how it's working and if it's effective. May I ask a point of clarification?
Yes.
I just, when Is this process intended just for those regulations where we may want to be more restrictive and not for all? I'm just clarifying the intent of the language here.
Marilyn?
Mr. Chairman, this language is intended, this is intended to apply to two situations. A, standards that the state would like to have that are more restrictive than the federal standards, and B, standards that the state would like to have that are not addressed by EPA standards. Those are the only two situations it would cover.
Then everything else would be equivalent to the federal guidelines or regulations.
That's correct.
Through the chair, do you think this would cover an issue such as arsenic, where we want to be? I guess one of the words that jumps out at me is consistent with. I had it earlier, but consistent with or not more restrictive, and we don't want to be in a position of having to adopt or. Be consistent with the federal government if we determine that it doesn't fit our state, or that we have a lot of that particular, you know, arsenic, I guess, is the best example. We have so much of it naturally occurring, and we sometimes do have a problem with EPA understanding that arsenic is a natural occurrence and not something that everybody's just running around with little files in their pockets. So I really would urge that you think about that, and the fact that when I read consistent with, I assume that means we adopt exactly what they have, which I will point out we have for the most part done. Through the years, we've adopted over 6,000 pages of federal registers that all are EPA criteria, a lot of it narratives, some of it numbers. So I think largely we are following it to the degree we feel that needs to be in statute. That's fine, but let's give ourselves some flexibility to also not necessarily be consistent.
Representative Osterman?
I'm going to ask probably a dumb question here, but I haven't followed the water qualities as near as I should have, nor the air quality standards, although I have talked to DEC on a number of different occasions when I've been involved in the hunting camp, for example, on Kodiak Island. And at that point in time, there was a real problem because of the way the EPA regulations were being proposed on how you were supposed to run your water supplies. At that point in time, I was told that they were the exact same water supply that I had to run in Zachary Bay on Kodiak Island that was being run in Anchorage and Seattle and Las Vegas. And so I get a little bit concerned when I start reading things here that we're going to maybe go higher than what the EPA allows. My question, I guess, leads back to is, why are we putting in statute here that allows the state to, or makes the state need to go higher than what EPA is doing, when EPA, in a lot of their instances, are higher now than we want? And
well, I think it depends on the particular pollutant that you're talking about. If we have a background count, for example, that may be higher than the federal standard, we need to make some exception to that. I mean, this is a naturally occurring thing. But I'll defer to the experts. Excuse me, Representative Barnes, there are several ahead of you. Does anybody have an answer to the question, either Susan or?
Through the chair, the best way I could probably answer that is to say we may have a circumstance in Alaska that meets the criteria that Ms. Crockett mentioned that she felt was the intent of these. One being that we have a situation, and I don't have anything off the top of my head to offer as an example, where it's not recognized nationally, and yet it may be causing a pollution problem that could be a health related issue or something where we have very strong concerns and we want to go higher than the national average. I hate to even bring this up, but thinking of what we went through with the human health criteria, and we set our human health criteria risk level at 10 to the minus 5, but we have to fall back to national defaults, and the national default fish consumption rate is something like 4.5 pounds a year. And one of the very strong arguments we got from people throughout the state was that in factoring that human health criteria number, we were using a national default that was incredibly lower than what we have up here, as well as it used an average weight of you know, maybe 150 pounds or 120 pounds, and we have old people and young children in villages where, you know, so that might be maybe not the best example, but I think there are circumstances where we as a state want to be stricter on something that's been set at the national standard that has to do with the water quality standards. And also the point, the other intent being that there may be a criteria or a standard that again, is something that the national government isn't going to spend much time on. They don't see it nationally as a big deal, and yet it's a circumstance that Alaska has concerns about.
Representative Davies?
Well, yeah, I was just generally, you know, I think clearly what we're contemplating in this is the exceptional case.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have a whole bunch of other language that's attached to it. But it seems to me it's more likely it would be a case where EPA doesn't have a standard at all, which is the B case that Marilyn indicated that we would want to provide for.
Thank you. Representative Barnes?
Thank you. My question has to do with the Anchorage discharge water.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding, and it may have happened more than once, that the water that Anchorage discharged was cleaner than, you know what I'm talking about, and they had to make it dirtier before it would meet the standards to discharge it. Whose standard was that, yours or the EPA's?
Through the chair, I'm not really sure. I am familiar with the circumstance you're describing. I because of where I am in my job, I touch on some of these issues that are, you know, that are being dealt with in some of our other, you know, field offices. And I'm trying to recall what the issue, as I understood, with the municipality did have something to do with being required to I think it had to do with natural occurrence. I don't know if it was meaning arsenic or, again, arsenic is one of those ones that always pops in. And they were being required to take that out, even though they were the source they were getting it from had it in their natural, and they're just putting it right back out into Cook Inlet.
Mr. Chairman, if I might help the Representative Barnes to save her voice
on this point.
On this point was the situation when Mayor Fink was mm-hmm. the mayor, and he had to introduce actually the tailings from a fish processing plant in Anchorage into the effluent system for discharge to meet mm-hmm. the standard.
That's my understanding. Thank you for helping.
Through the chair, I would really like to follow up on that. Maybe we can do it outside of here and I could get a little bit more information. I unfortunately can't speak for what has happened in the past, but I am certainly interested in making sure that what is ridiculous in everybody's eyes and what is not reasonable and what does not make sense is not a part of what we're doing. I don't have the time, I don't have the staff, we got a lot of important issues, and I would really like to talk about that, you know, maybe outside of this formal setting.
Yes, Representative Williams.
Yeah. One of the problems I think the industry has is being consistent with or higher than EPA standards. And when the department gets into an area, they think that it should be higher than. Do you have a problem with the peer review that I think Marilyn Crockett mentioned in there? You know, because I think that if you do need to go higher, I agree, but we should have a peer review.
Through the chair, I think we probably have to define what peer review is and make sure that we are as objective as possible. The one thing that I feel strongly about as the keeper of these regulations is, and you know, the responsibility of keeping the water quality clean in Alaska is that we try to keep, I'll say, politics out of it, in the sense that so I think if we had a setup where we could get a peer review that was objective. I will say right up front, I am entirely in support of peer review processes that really, really get down to the nitty-gritty of what the issues are. And I will say quite honestly that if I can point to a failing of DEC in the past, it's been that staff, very well-intended staff, have not made the effort to get out and get all the information to be able to make a determination, and that, you know, I'll say in some cases we've had somebody in a position for a long period of time who felt they knew that subject better than anyone else and made a decision. And even though reams of information might come into the contrary, you know, they kind of deposited it and made their decision. And I've seen that happen in you know, more than a couple situations, and I'm very committed to make sure that we don't do that. And I guess that's been my bottom line with these regulations is they're technical, they're complex, they're extremely important to the state, but we cannot be operating in a vacuum. And I think we do have instances where that's been the case. So I would be very much in favor of something like that.
Be very much in favor of peer review.
Yes. I would like it to be defined so that I would feel like whether that was a university or a, you know, some agreed upon expert in the field that you know was outside of the department but perhaps not politically identified.
Are there any other comments to this point? What it appears to me that we have I've got about five issues here that were left kind of as hang points, and what I would admonish the maker of the bill perhaps to get with both AOGA and DEC and decide what we should do about these, and at least from my list, we've got this problem about the 303D EPA approved 303D situation on sections 1 and 2, and that carries over then where we had this problem of more or less restrictive. We got down on the 12-month versus a 3-year review of federal changes. We've got the concern about those specific cases where the state may want to either be above or below the federal standard. You were going to look up something about this sewage effluent situation in Anchorage, and then maybe coming up with a definition of what peer really is. Representative Davies.
We also had the issue of existing versus natural quality.
Beg pardon?
The issue of existing versus natural quality of the receiving water.
Okay, yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Roeckberg.
Just very briefly in conclusion, I think you just touched on it, though, about the we've allowed in this new CS the potentiality to make higher standards, but I think the arsenic case brings to mind a situation where we may want to authorize DEC to even pursue in the courts if necessary a lower standard if it was amenable to the interest of the state. So I think we can handle that, but you know, give you that not restrict you statutorily in not doing that. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I beg your indulgence. I was looking at higher and lower in the opposite. When I answered Representative Osterman's question, I was looking in the opposite direction. But
Mr. Chairman, the thought occurred to me. If I want to bring that up to make sure Marilyn understood my point, and get some feedback from everybody else on that, because we don't want to tie their hands in the event that would be in our best interest.
Ms. Crockett, did you hear Representative Roeckberg? Marilyn?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, did you hear Representative Roeckberg?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I understand that he's concerned that we want to make sure that this bill doesn't do something inadvertently that would not allow us to be less restrictive than the federal standard.
Right. Will there be a possibility that you and the representative and the person or persons from DEC might be able to get together, work these issues over, and possibly be back to us by Monday?
We'll do our best, Mr. Chairman, and keep you informed of the process. Monday morning, 8 o'clock, may be a little tough, but I'll keep you abreast of any developments in that regard.
All right. Representative Davies.
Chair, there was also another issue, which was the methods. EPA approved methods.
EPA, I'm sorry.
EPA approved methods.
Yes. Now this
we
is
had some,
different from the EPA approved that we talked about earlier.
I'm specifically on page 1, line 17. There's a proposed requirement that the DEC shall use methods approved by the EPA.
I didn't realize that was a problem.
And I had suggested that perhaps there'd be some language that said that's assuming that such a method exists first, and secondly that if the state placed in writing a reason for deviating from that would be
okay. I think that's incorporated in some of these other things we talked
yeah.
about.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I might ask Representative Davies to maybe help us on that a little bit. So.
Are there any other questions or comments about where we stand on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Mac McClain in Fairbanks.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Mac.
Yeah, I apologize for not having touched on this earlier, but I had some problems with the phone. But we would appreciate having a little bit of clarification in terms of what the intent is for Section 1, given that the department does not condition its permits with numerical and device limitations.
I don't understand the question.
Any comments on that from any of the people that are going to be working the issue? Is there clarification? What's he asking about?
Yeah, I don't understand what he's...
What we're asking is, in our permitting, we do not address water quality. We defer to DEC on that. So our permits do not contain end-of-pipe discharge limitations. So our question is, what is this bill trying to address in terms of Fish and Game's permitting program?
I'm not sure. We're talking about water quality rather than critters.
That's our question. And Section 1 includes a provision that would relate to Fish and Game, and we're somewhat at a loss to understand what it is that's trying to be addressed here.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Roper.
One of the intents here, I think, is to make sure all the departments are on the same page and they're all consistent in the application of the statute and policy regarding this, so we don't have to be fighting a battle with different departments, that's all.
Okay, just contingency?
Just more coordination, I think, is the word.
You need to lean forward when you talk.
Coordination, I think, would be the intent.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments? We have a Bill Perarch? Perarch. Would you please come forward and do this?
Mr. Chairman, it's all right with the committee. We'd like to testify on Monday.
Monday, okay.
Thank you.
Any other people want to be heard now? Hearing none, we know our charge, and we're dismissed at 9:37. Yes. The question?
Yes. Okay.
There's a Monday, so one.